Right now, it feels like we should be joined by David Terechuk. It's time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Thursday, on a Friday morning, that is. We rebroadcast it after the noon news. Also, on the weekend, David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief. Good morning, David.
Well, good morning to you. I'm reporting in from, as usual, as so often, from the media capital of the world, New York City, and I'd like to wish you a very good Juneteenth.
Well, you know, Juneteenth, we very briefly spoke about it when I called you this morning, and, you know, when I was in high school, John Mahoney, and this is back in 1971 as a senior, we actually had a Black History Club, and I joined it, and it was an eye-opening, a very eye-opening experience for me to learn about things that I learned. But way back in 1971, I learned about 1865, Juneteenth. And then also we talked about the Tulsa race riots. And earlier this year...
In 1921. Yes, indeed.
And earlier this year, HBO came out with their own version of a movie that that I watched. It was their version of The Watchmen, and it opened up with out of the first hour, 25 minutes, showing what happened during the Tulsa race riots. So I was amazed yesterday when I heard the President of the United States say that if it wasn't for him, nobody would know what Juneteenth is and the Tulsa race riots. It was,
right,
once again, a new low reached in trying to squirm out of something.
Absolutely. Well, you know, like a lot of journalists, and you included, like, clearly I've made a point of marking Juneteenth in my journalism. You probably recall we did it together a couple of years ago, mm-hmm, when I wrote a column from France about it, because I was in France on June 19th. 2 years ago, and a very important development happened there, because not necessarily to mark Juneteenth, but in reaction to the abandonment, as France saw it, of America's commitment to ideals of things like racial equality and freedom, human freedom in general, made a remarkable shift in position. The reason I was in France was really to, well, in part at the time, to report on the changing attitudes in Europe towards the United States, and it was just 20 years after the Juneteenth proclamation, the proclamation of, it was not the proclamation itself, but the fact that it took 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation in Washington for news of that proclamation to get to and to take effect in the furthest west slaveholding state, that of course was Texas. So Juneteenth was a proclamation that was read in Galveston, Texas. But the historical resonance of it was reverberating on June 19th in 2018, when France was recollecting that it was only it was sometime later anyway. I'm getting my dates all tied up in this complicated matrix. Just because Juneteenth happened 2 years after the proclamation for emancipation itself was proclaimed, and then took a while for the Union General to read it aloud in far distant western Texas, the western state of Texas, down in the southern part of the state at Galveston. But following that, as a recognition of America's commitment to freedom, to racial freedom, and also to an openness to accept refugees, that was when France decided to give America that enormous gift here that sits in New York City, in New York City Harbor, the Statue of Liberty. And it was at that point that on the anniversary in June that President Macron of France decided to, not himself, but use his mouthpiece, his official spokesman, to say the following: we don't have the same model of civilization, meaning the United States and France. A massive change in the 200 years since that friendly gift was given. Clearly, we do not share certain values, and obviously our job is to defend a European ideal, our ideal of peace and of freedom. So, you know, much has been shattered by Trump over matters like racial freedom and the sense of America being a beacon to the rest of the world of these fine values. Here we have another example in the Trump administration deciding in such an extraordinarily ill-informed way that the best place to gear up the Trump election campaign was to be Tulsa in Oklahoma as a site for a presidential rally, in spite of COVID-19 and the restrictions that apply to all of us, and the fact, of course, that Oklahoma is experiencing one of those delayed spikes that seem to be happening in all the states where early opening up has been taking place. But it is extraordinary that his communications advisor, Brad Pascale, the so-called genius when it comes to social media, didn't recognize that the date they chose was June 19th, and didn't seem to understand the importance of Tulsa, that appalling race riot that happened in 1921, a race riot, in fact, that was a racial massacre, whites killing possibly as many as 300 black people in the Greenwood area of Tulsa, an area that was known as the Black Wall Street because it was such a prosperous group of black individuals and families, something that was evidently intolerable to the white majority. I've been aware of that since I made a documentary about another racial massacre that happened 2 years later, and there were many echoes of it from Tulsa in the place where I reported on, not Greenwood, but Rosewood, a relatively prosperous community, not urban, but rural in Florida, where we don't know how many people were killed there. And my documentary was about that secret being kept for, seven decades, eight decades, until we were able to report on it in the late 1990s. So this is indeed a redolent date, and the tapestry, the ugly backside of the tapestry of American commitments to freedom and the appalling transgressions of the freedom ideal that slavery represented are really important subjects for pondering and consideration, and you know, the advances that have been made be honored on a day like this, June 19th.
You know, it's interesting because in discussing what happened in Tulsa, it was never talked about as a riot. It was talked about, as you just said, a massacre. No one was rioting. The black community was attacked not only by land and by people, but also by air, dropping homemade bombs and completely.
Sure. Yeah. It was a most appalling civil disorder. The vengeful white crowd running amok. If anyone was rioting, it was they.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things, and that's where this president really, really falls down. You can disagree with Donald Trump on a lot of things, on his policies, but you everybody, and it's not this way. Even the people who support him just won't recognize that he is just not well versed in American history. He is not well versed in foreign history, which is coming out with the new book by the Antichrist, as I call him.
The mustachioed Antichrist, John Bolton. You're talking about the former National Security Advisor.
But you take all this into context, and all the generals that have worked for him that have quit, where the man literally has no idea what the presidency is all about to this country and its history and the country's history and its relationship to the rest of the world.
And as you were saying, it's quite extraordinary that he now, having found something out, he suddenly realizes that this is something he should have known and tries to claim that he has promulgated the notion of Juneteenth himself. He gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal, making that extraordinary claim you referenced earlier, that he has made Juneteenth famous. And nobody knew about it before until he did this. It's, as you say, it's a new low.
Yeah, just when you think that his lack of depth and understanding of the United States in general and the world in general is bad, it hits a new low. And I don't know how much lower it can go from here, but I'm sure we'll find out in the next several months, because what we have in our country now is, and it's funny, if you look in Europe and you look in Italy and you look in every place else that's been affected by COVID-19, COVID-19 didn't become a political football. But in the United States, a pandemic obviously becomes, what is the bottom line? It becomes a political football in the United States. We are just in really astoundingly bad times.
Yeah, and of course, we don't know what his next steps will be. But I think we're trained by experience to expect that it will indeed only get worse. But we are in an election season. It may change, of course. It may change completely.
All right. Something else I woke to in the headline status this morning, and it was Kim Jong-un's sister is more and more in the news. And the Korean situation once again has ratcheted up with the North Koreans blowing up that center.
The cooperation center between North Korea and South Korea. Yes, very interesting instance two countries, I guess, because ever since the split in the 1950s. The two countries who are at odds with each other but have managed to create some form of coexistence across that demilitarized zone that separates them. But yes, one of the elements of that demilitarized zone was a building in which some communication happened between the two countries. And it's a pretty undiplomatic way of saying that you're not happy with the other side and its conduct to actually blow up the building in which you meet.
And so the Korean experiment obviously once again fails. This time it's failed numerous times with the Democratic and Republican presidents, because anytime something was reached out via text or by a third party, it always wound up failing. And this time the president of the United States actually gave credence to the North Korean leader by showing up at two meetings, which provided absolutely nothing on paper, and now we see in reality, once again, has provided actually nothing in the relationship between North and South Korea.
Yeah, the obduracy of the North Koreans remains just as evident as ever, whatever efforts may be made by the rest of the world, and of course their most immediate neighbor, their once upon a time fellow countrymen, the South Koreans. We seem to be back where we started.
And, looking at the coronavirus and the interesting story that I read this morning, we here in the United States have always thought that the coronavirus was here in late December and very early January. And now, according to a story I heard this morning coming in on BBC, that in Italy, the virus was in Italy in December. Now they study through testing wastewater that's when the virus was in Italy also. And I think I think this is a game changer in regards to the way the Chinese have tried to not accept responsibility for the cat getting out of the bag or the horses or the cows getting out of the barn. But it's obvious now that December is the date that the world unknowingly became COVID-19 captured.
Right, right. And and all the epidemiological research that's been done shows that our first recorded case of it on the West Coast was already preceded, though not recorded, by its presence within our shores at a very early stage too. It's and it helps the situation not a single jot to have the disease simply labeled a Chinese virus, which seems to be the increasing line from the administration, especially when it comes to things like its electoral campaigning. All the surrogates for Trump are beginning to use that phrase and reassert the notion of it being some kind of invasion. The whole notion of what the global health situation actually is, which is of course that all diseases have the capacity. That's a terrible exaggeration on my part, but it is a general quality that infectious diseases have, that they are not respecters of national frontiers. And to talk about the nationality of a disease is just a really misleading, deliberately misleading in this case, I believe, misstatement of the truth.
Yeah, and add to that we now have dropped out of funding of the WHO, and this is a case in point where I'm a progressive. There's a lot of things I don't like about trade deals that were made, but the United States really has backed out of almost, I would say, 75% of the world-encompassing agreements on health, on the environment, on racism,
trade. Uh-huh.
Trade. It's absolutely amazing how in 3 short years, we are now an island alone. We really are.
Yes, and attempting to ring fence our country against the rest of the world. It's such a remarkable abandonment of America's sometimes overreaching, but very proud position as a leader in the world. That phrase, leader of the free world, always had a sort of somewhat queasy making feel to it. But at least we could say that we did stand for some ideals, like the French admired us for and gave us the gift of the Statue of Liberty for. It's something that I think can only be redressed by a major shift in the country's position in the world, and some future administration, I hope, will take the steps to reassert America's position in the world. It's certainly what much of the rest of the world, if you look at their media as I do every week, you'll see that they greatly regret the retreat of America, and they want America back in their midst again, pulling its full weight as a responsible member of the world community.
And then again, yesterday, the Supreme Court in their decision saved DACA for the moment. I mean, it's only a momentary reprieve. It's really going to depend on the next election, because what the Supreme Court said yesterday, and I think Chief Judge Roberts is doing his best to try to take the politicism out of the Supreme Court. I really do believe that. I don't agree with a lot of his decisions, but I think he's trying like hell to keep the Supreme Court separate from the shenanigans that go on at the White House and the Senate. But by saying that, it just
I think it seems like he's had enough.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As the Supreme Court justice, the Chief Justice, it's all obviously a completely unenviable role given this administration. But it's interesting to see that he's holding to some consistent line. He's conservative by nature, I think, but that he's trying, I think, and trying quite interestingly and quite successfully most of the time to distinguish any kind of political judgments he may be holding in his own head from the judicial decisions he has to make. And that's pretty clear here. He also points out, of course, in this judgment that it is a kind of procedural judgment,
yeah.
And it's not against the principle of whether or not DACA is a justifiable piece of executive action by the previous president. What he's saying is that this administration, in trying to rescind it, didn't go through the right procedures in order to do so. So it's perfectly open to the Trump administration to try again and do it in a way that does pass muster with the Supreme Court. But of course, we're just a few months now away from an election, so the likelihood of that happening with any speediness is nil.
Yeah, and I think that's what I like about the Supreme Court decisions. I think it was a 400 and some odd page decision, and it lays out really the groundwork for both sides. The sides that want to defeat and get rid of DACA, and the sides of people that want to keep DACA enforced. I think one of the great things about the way the decision was written, it said, okay, here's what we found, and here's what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, on the subject of this particular judgment, and indeed other judgments that have been happening with John Roberts, the Chief Justice, acting in this role of safeguarding the independence of the decision making that takes place at the, amongst those nine supremes, as they're sometimes called. I want to do what I've been doing a lot these last few weeks, is singling out a really good example. Most of my time is in a column called The Media Beat and a show with you called The Media Beat. I'm beating the media. I'm criticizing it, but I'm trying to be pretty resolute in my determination these days to single out examples of good media practice and not just beat the media, but praise it when necessary. But my example of good, indeed best practice in journalism this week is a bit of a cheat on my part. It's not technically really journalism, but it's satire, in fact. But it's satire that's so good that I think in a way it qualifies as journalism for the way that it analyzes current events. And it comes from Andy Borowitz, the writer of The New Yorker,
yeah.
Who does the daily, well, often more than daily, Borowitz Report. I think you're a follower like me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, well, his response to this particular story, following this and the LGBTQ decision that the Supreme Court made earlier in the week, his comment on all of that is absolutely goes to the core of the whole issue, the issue of, you know, what happens when the legal arm of government is at odds with the executive arm of government, when the executive arm of government is the arm of an extremely what I mean is, when Trump's the president, if you're the Chief Justice, life is not easy. And this, it's a kind of prediction about what might happen next. And as ever, Andy Borowitz is successful as a satirist because he matches the tone perfectly and the conventions and the habits of real journalism, as it were, to make his points. So here's the Borowitz report. Borowitz report from Washington. A day after it has issued decisions on LGBTQ rights and on DACA that provoked his ire, Donald J. Trump said that he would overrule the Supreme Court by creating a Supremer Court. That's what we can expect next. Right, and he quotes his notional Trump. Right now, if the Supreme Court makes a bad decision, quite frankly, you're screwed, he said. The Supreme Court, the new Supremer Court will fix that. Trump said that his Supremer Court would be a beautiful, perfect court that would make the Supreme Court, quote, look exactly like it is, a sad bunch of losers. Trump said that the Supremer Court would be housed in a, quote, giant gleaming building overlooking the Supreme Court, enabling the Supremer Court justices to, quote, look down on those pathetic little Supreme Court jerks and laugh. Well, gets the tone of it all, I'm afraid. It gets absolutely the tone of the Trump administration and of Trump himself. It's a comic. Really comic. It made me laugh out loud, but at the same time, it's a really sad reflection, like a lot of good satire, on the way things are with our government.
I couldn't agree with you more. The Borowitz report, when it comes out, even the condensed version of it on a daily basis, it makes you laugh. But the great thing about true journalism, Borowitz or actually a beat writer, is that in the end, true journalism makes you think and get involved in a topic.
Yeah, and the issues raised here are just exactly what we need to be considering as we ponder our vote for November. What kind of relationship do we want to see between the White House and the Supreme Court? And indeed with Congress. That's a subject for another day, but the way that this particular Congress, Senate certainly, has failed to provide the kind of oversight and counterbalance to the White House during these last 3 years is something that we all need to think about very seriously.
And that's Republicans and Democrats alike. The separation of power, which has slowly been eroded by very many presidents over the Congress and the Senate, but even more particularly by this president, sooner or later has to come back into balance. That's what makes this government and this experiment called America successful, is the separation of powers from the presidency to the Senate and House and to the, of course, Supreme Court. They are all equal but separate, and it hasn't been that way. It's been eroding, and now it's just about completely washed away. But like I said, the Supreme Court seems to be fighting back against that.
Absolutely.
Well, David, it's always great to talk to you. We'll see what comes up in the next 7 days of events.
I can't wait. Talk to you next week.
Take care.
Bye-bye now.
That is David Terechuk, the Media Beat here on Robinhood Radio. And once again, that's every Friday. We rebroadcast it after the new news the next week and also on the weekend. You'll always find it at the Media Beat at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand and click on the Media Beat.